from KUT and KUTX Studios.
This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of November 2019. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. The state of Texas moves homeless camps from under overpasses as Austin clears the area around the arch.
It's confusing. It's tiring.
Capital Metro crunches the numbers on a big expansion of public transit.
You could add more money depending on where it would go.
And why you might see tarantulas around town.
They can live surprisingly a long time, anywhere from like 8 to 25 years.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
We honestly have voters who realize once they take the card out of their ballot marking device and walk over to the ballot box that what they're finding is they just can put it in their pocket and walk out and they think they're leaving with a souvenir.
This is the Travis County clerk, Dana DeBeauvoir, explaining this week why election results on Tuesday night did not come out till 4 a.m. Wednesday morning, when normally by 10 p.m. they're mostly out. And she said voters are just getting used to these new machines, these new voting machines that include the use of a paper ballot.
We think there also might be a factor involved in that the previous system we gave them a four-digit code on a little sticker that also had the time and date on it. So it was like a little receipt that reminded them that they had already voted. Well, it's not exactly the same thing, but you can kind of see where voters might get the idea that they like having something to take home that says they voted. Well, just like in any regular paper ballot election, if you take your ballot home, you have not voted. So these are 8 or 10 or, you know, a few, and it was only a few people, who learned some lessons the hard way that if you take your ballot home, you have lost your right to vote.
Now, because of this, once the ballot boxes made it to the Travis County Clerk's office on Airport Boulevard, some of them had fewer cards in them than the number of voters who checked in at the voting center from which the cards came. If that happens, and the difference is 4 votes or greater, under state law, the cards from that voting center need to be manually rescanned. And that took until about 3:45 in the morning.
Okay, so we're in the process of fully assessing our performance from this election. Our starting point is that our goal is to deliver voters a reliable and secure election so that the results are something that they can really count on. So we're confident that we can do that, but we're going to need to actually put some things in place. There's always opportunity to improve. So we're going to work with the Secretary of State's office between now and the primary to address some of these retabulation requirements to see if there's a better way to produce results that have already been audited. We're going to work to recruit more poll workers. We would have done that anyway for the primaries. We're going to be more active on social media to educate voters about everybody can't show up at 5 o'clock on election day. We cannot manage the demand of 20% of our voters voting after 5 o'clock at a few locations. And we're going to try to communicate to our voters better about we have tools to help them select places that are not so crowded and to educate them about the problems that are caused when voters line up and create a 3-hour line. And then finally, we want to streamline our procedures here because now that we have an electronically supported paper trail system, we have a lot of manual procedures, and it is very like holding two elections at the same time. We're conducting the electronic part of it and the paper part of it, and all of it must stay synced at all times.
By the way, these problems happened with 15% turnout in Travis County. So with the presidential primaries coming up in the spring, the Travis County clerk has limited time before a real test of the new machines. By the way, statewide turnout, 12%. So let's get to the results. All 10 proposed amendments to the Texas Constitution were approved, except for Proposition 1. That was the one that would have allowed a person to hold more than one office as a municipal judge at the same time. Austin and Travis County voters had their say on the use of city land and county tourist tax dollars. KUT's Jimmy Moss has those results.
Voters struck down Austin's Proposition A, a petition-led ordinance that would have forced votes on most future uses of city-owned land and made the organizations that lease those lands, frequently nonprofits, to pay property taxes. Travis County voters approved the countywide Proposition A, which will direct 2% of the hotel occupancy tax to go toward renovating the Travis County Expo Center. This will only go into effect when the city is done paying off its convention center debt, which could happen as soon as 2021. However, that debt may have an extended life because Austin's Proposition B failed. That allows a teardown and remodel of the convention center already approved by the city council to move forward. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
Four school districts in Central Texas asked voters to approve bond packages in the election. KUT's Claire McInerney tells us half of them passed, half did not pass.
Voters in Manor and Del Valle ISD voted to approve their bond packages. Manor is trying to keep up with its growing student population and will use the money to expand classrooms and build new schools. Del Valle will use its bond money to do various construction projects in the district and get new technology. Bonds for Lockhart ISD and Burnett CISD failed. Lockhart was also trying to expand its schools to meet a growing population. Burnett's bond would not have raised the tax rate for voters. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
This week, city officials started breaking up homeless encampments around the Austin Resource Center for the Homeless. As KUT's Andrew Weber reports, the cleanup Monday began as the state started clearing out camps under overpasses in South Austin.
A crew of a little more than a dozen city workers began disassembling camps and tossing mattresses, some tents, and other belongings into a dumpster across the street from the Salvation Army's downtown shelter. Greg McCormick is the executive director of Front Steps, the nonprofit that runs the arch. He says the timing for all of this could have been better.
Yeah, the timing is not ideal for sure. Things just kind of fell in line to where this was happening. APD was ready to go with this, and the state evidently is starting their cleanups under the underpasses.
The removal is required by new city ordinances that, among other things, ban camping near the city-owned shelter. Crystal Harris has been camping in the area. The 24-year-old says she only cares about her blanket and a teddy bear. It used to belong to her mom, who died 2 years ago.
My mom only been gone 2 years, and that's still one touchy spot to me. I would act a plumb fool if they was to come over here and bother my stuff right now. But y'all not, it's confusing, it's tiring.
Harris and others said the workers ended up tossing some personal belongings, not just trash, surrounding the camps, and complained the city didn't provide caseworkers to help people displaced by the city's new rules. Protesters shouted down police escorting workers as they made the rounds and tossed pallets and tents into a trash compactor. Later in the day, crews working with the Texas Department of Transportation began clearing up camps under overpasses in South Austin. Those cleanups were ordered by Governor Greg Abbott. He's argued the Austin City Council's policies to address homelessness have made things worse in the city. TxDOT says those cleanups will be weekly, but the schedule for them isn't clear. A TxDOT spokesperson told KUT the situation is, quote, fluid. The state is pushing people displaced from those camps to the Arch, which had about 170 people on its wait list as of Monday morning. McCormick told the state that the Arch is full, but didn't get much of a reaction.
You know, we're full right now, and so I let them know that. They're aware of it, but I'm sure that some people may still come here.
Crystal Harris said she, like others outside the Arch, weren't sure what would come next.
Where is there to go? They're not, that's how they... All this is really to try to intimidate somebody. There's nowhere to go.
Andrew Weber, KUT News. Thank you.
If you're one of those people who spends hours each week stuck in traffic, the thought may have crossed your mind at some point. What would it take for Austin to have a subway system? Because unlike most buses, subways can go faster than traffic during rush hour, but they do not come cheap. And now the region's public transit agency, Capital Metro, has actually come out with a price tag for what you might call a starter subway system in Austin, one of several options under consideration. KUT's transportation reporter Samuel King has been covering this process. Hello, Samuel.
Hi, Nathan.
What is Capital Metro considering that I am calling a subway line and they are not calling a subway line?
Yeah, the only thing in their documents they use is maybe a tunnel,
right?
So to speak. To step back a little bit, you know, under the Project Connect plan, the latest Project Connect plan that's been out for maybe about a year or more now, there's two main lines that Cap Metro's identified, the orange and the blue lines. The orange would run north-south in the Guadalupe Lamar corridor and South Congress area. Blue would run roughly east of the UT campus, maybe a little north of there out to Austin Bergstrom. So Cap Metro has to decide whether they would run at street level, elevated, or underground. Now, these would be dedicated pathway line, so they wouldn't mix with normal traffic. They wouldn't be stuck like sometimes the buses are. Or, you know, they could do some combination of at the street, elevated, or underground. They don't have to go underground or elevated completely because there are some parts on the ends of the lines that probably it wouldn't make sense to. They can just start on the street level. But they have identified some potential costs. For instance, if they were going to do this downtown, just downtown, that would add about $2 or $2.5 billion to the cost of the project.
To put it underground?
Downtown, yes. Yeah. Depending on what they do, if they make the lines connect, if they share a pathway, that's at the very least. You could add more money depending on where it would go underground. Elevated might be possible for some of the line, and definitely street level for part of the line too.
What about if they elevated it above street level?
In terms of that cost, on the orange line, they're estimating it'd be about $3.8 billion for sort of a light rail line elevated. And then on the blue line, that would go out to the airport again, that would be about $2.5 billion for elevated.
How would this be paid for?
That's a good question, Nathan. So to the start, when you talk about a massive transit plan, you're looking to get a chunk of it from the federal government. They are hoping at least 40% of the potential costs would come from the federal government. That means the rest of that money would have to come from here somehow. So part of that is likely at this point, but no guarantee yet, some sort of bond election, borrowing however many dollars they feel they would need. And there is some local funding too, from some combination of Campo or the various local governments that could also help pay for this. For an example, Houston this week had a bond election there for transit, including a light rail line that would go out to Hobby Airport and a bus rapid line that would go up to Bush Airport. That bond was $3.5 billion. They're hoping to get $3 billion from the federal government, another $500 million in some kind of combination of local funds. So they would be looking at that here somewhere. There's been a lot of look at Houston, what they've been doing with their bond process, looking ahead to next year. But it won't come cheap to do this sort of massive project, depending on what they want to do.
Right. And I think you've explained this to me before. The plan would not be to do this all at once. So it's not like you're going to see a $5 billion bond on the ballot.
Potentially. You could see a $5 billion bond on the ballot, or you could see something less than that. There's still going to be a lot of discussion. And these elevated and underground options, at least the elevated option, it could be this bus rapid transit. You could see them using buses on one or both of the lines, and that would be a lot cheaper. But the trade-off you get there is that would carry fewer people. So you have a lot of people who are pro-transit in Austin who like the idea of bus rapid transit on some of the other lines. But when you're talking about these main lines and some of the congested parts of the city, they feel that rail is the best option because it would carry more people. You know, it's a big trade-off, and that's something that Cap Metro and the city of Austin elected officials are going to be asking the community to decide. Like, how big do you really want to go with this project?
How many people does Capital Metro think would use this if it were bus rapid transit or light rail or whatever?
On the Orange Line, and let's say some sort of partial elevation, and you would conceivably think that underground would probably do this too on the rail, they're thinking 74,000 passengers by 2040. And that may sound like a big number.
Per day?
Per day. But keep in mind, the population of the region is expected to double, the five-county metro, by 2040. So again, these are 2040 numbers. And then with another 66,000 passengers, if we see some sort of bus rapid transit. On the Blue Line, they're anticipating 52,000 on rail, with 45,000 on buses, again, if it's partially elevated along the line. Now, some transit advocates have questioned those numbers. They feel that trains could actually carry more. But Capital Metro is saying this is the projections we have. Looked at what other cities are doing, what we're projecting the region's population to be. So with this sort of plan and where they are right now. So that, I mean, that's a difference.
Yeah.
The question is, what people are going to consider, is that big enough difference to spend more money or allocate more money or approve more money to spend on a small rail system in Austin versus adding dedicated bus rapid transit?
Earlier, you said they'll be looking to the public. What kind of public events are they holding?
You know, there have been open houses this week talking about this plan. Now that they've released this last week and they had the big work session between the city council and the Capital Metro Board, and now they have all these projections and the new sort of plan. The map is a little different. So now they're taking that back out to people. So they had one separately on the Metro Rapid Service, the 801, 803, or the Bendy buses, as people call them. And they're also having separate ones Wednesday and Thursday about the separate lines. And so they're having it at two separate places for the Blue Line and the Orange Line to give people a closer look at not only sort of the potential route, which is what they've had before, but now that we have these estimates, now that we have these conceptions of what the pathway could be and how much they would cost, giving people more information about that.
How far away are we from there being any type of actual decision on this?
So the Cap Metro Board and Austin City Council will meet again jointly in January. They're going to discuss, okay, how do we finance this? What are sort of the potential avenues, federal money, some of the local money that we spoke about? Then there has to be some other meetings, including CAMPO has to get involved in terms of having to apply for the federal funding, because they're the agency that distributes that funding in the area. And the Cap Metro Board would have to approve, okay, this is a transit plan we have. So what they have to do is come up with what's called a locally preferred alternative to present to the feds to apply for that 40% match that they're seeking. So they have to come up with that. And that's why you're having these open houses and these work sessions and all that. So we're expecting that to happen sometime in the spring. Perhaps as late as May, they'll have a final decision, and that's what's going to be presented to the voters if they do decide to go ahead with a bond election. And again, they're targeting November 2020. They're expecting a big turnout for that race, obviously.
Right. There'll be some other races on the ballot along
exactly.
with it.
Yeah.
KUT's transportation reporter, Samuel King. You can find more of his reporting on this at KUT.org. Thank you so much, Samuel.
Thank you.
A lot of people born in the United States speak Spanglish. That's a version of Spanish that's been influenced by contact with English. The dialect is sometimes looked down upon by native speakers of both languages. Texas Public Radio's Camille Phillips recently visited a college in San Antonio where Latinx students are learning to challenge those negative perceptions.
In a classroom above the chapel at St. Mary's University, more than a dozen students meet twice a week to talk about the history and culture of U.S. Spanish. Professor Megan Peace sets up today's lesson by emphasizing that the U.S. Spanish dialect, sometimes called Spanglish, is just as valid as any other Spanish dialect.
¿Por qué tenemos reacciones tan negativas sobre el Spanglish si ese contacto, ese cambio es normal?
Most of Peace's students grew up speaking a mix of Spanish and English. She asked if they ever get negative reactions when they code switch, and if so, why?
Hablan en los grupos.
Mary Valine says people who only speak one language sometimes assume she doesn't speak their language well if she code switches.
Te ven como que no sabes hablar bien. Pero lo que me molesta es cuando ellos nomás hablan un idioma.
She says it bothers her when people correct her, even though they don't know what she's saying. This class is a rare safe space for Spanglish, even in a state like Texas, where nearly 30% of the population speaks Spanish at home. Many of the students in this class have internalized the idea that it's better to speak, quote, pure Spanish.
I think the one that judges me the most is myself, because I want to be able to practice Spanish and be able to carry a conversation fully within Spanish.
Freshman Angie Bravo from Laredo, Texas, says her parents had to learn English as adults, so they never judged her for mixing it with Spanish.
I think they were just more so proud and relieved that I'm just able to speak English.
For others, there's a stigma around speaking Spanish. That's especially true for Hispanics whose families encountered strict English-only policies at school.
My grandparents talk a lot about being discriminated in school for speaking Spanish and, you know, being hit.
Alicia Carrillo's family has lived in San Antonio for generations. The international studies major says her mom and grandma speak Spanish, but they didn't really teach it to her.
I think just like subconsciously, they think like, oh, we're not supposed to speak that.
She says learning Spanish in school has felt like a way to reclaim part of her cultural identity. But at the same time, she gets frustrated by people who expect her to be able to speak the language flawlessly.
I think people get confused because they assume if you're brown, you speak perfect Spanish.
Their professor, Megan Peace, says her students know more Spanish than they think they do. Several of them were originally signed up for a lower-level class focused on grammar and vocabulary.
Because they thought they didn't speak it well. And on the first day, I heard them talking, and I said, oh, no, 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 don't give me that. You do know this.
Her goal is for her students to become more confident and learn how to defend their use of Spanglish. And she's not the only educator working to normalize the dialect. A 2016 survey found more than 40 universities across the country offer courses on Spanglish or U.S. Spanish. I'm Camille Phillips in San Antonio.
Libraries can be places of learning, places of wonder, or sometimes just a place to take a break from the demands of parenting. We partnered with Austin's Library Foundation to collect stories of what libraries mean to you in a series called Library Love Stories. Today's story comes to us from Sarah Rutan, a teacher in Austin, and also a mom of two kids.
This love story is about a love for books and my kids, and a recognition of how I love watching them grow through the books that we share. It is also about how, on the toughest days of parenting, the library is always there. There are few things you can count on as a parent. Kids are constantly changing, and what works one day is not always successful the next. In this world of inconsistencies and minor dramas, the library has always been a constant. As most Austin parents know, the library provides a cool escape on summer afternoons when the slides at the local park are scorching and you can't bring yourself to layer on sunscreen and swimsuits at the local pool. It is an AC-filled and quiet refuge. And for a few moments, at least, your kids don't need you. The summer after my daughter turned one, she learned the joy of pulling all of the books off of the library shelves. I would try to visit our local library with her and my 4-year-old son. I'd get distracted following him around to pick out books and then turn to find the entire picture book collection on the floor. Sheepishly, I'd pick up books and herd both kids quickly to the checkout before we could undo the entire organization scheme of the children's section. We'd return home to hours of snuggles and stories, books pouring out of the library bag. Soon, my daughter learned that she could pull books off of the shelves and make a high-pitched scream that would attract lots of attention. I'd have my hands full of books when the siren scream would happen. Quiet at first, as if to test, and then full blare until all of the library patrons were watching. I persisted in our weekly visits until, one day, the screaming commenced and the librarian politely asked me to leave. I said, yes, but could you first check these books out for me? I waited outside on the scorching pavement with a screaming toddler for our blessed bag of books, the bag that would get us all through the afternoon and to dinner time. We were strangers at the library for the remainder of that summer. And then, like all things parenting, the phase passed. Bravely, one day, we descended again upon the children's section. No one screamed. No books were thrown, and no librarians had to follow behind us picking up the pieces. We explored, we read, we played games, and we snuggled in our refuge. In that space, I felt less lonely as a parent. We've come a long ways from the summer of the scream. I've watched my kids grow as they move from the board books to the easy readers, to picture books, and on to the graphic novels. My oldest doesn't ask me to read to him anymore, and when we return from the library, I know he'll spend the afternoon on his own, lost in his latest chapter book. They have their own library cards and their own ideas about favorite books and authors. There are days when I wonder what they will take with them from our time together, what lessons will stick, and what experiences will matter. But I never question myself on our sacred library trips, because books, no matter what the age or parenting struggle, will always be a constant.
That was Austinite Sarah Rutan with her library love story. We've been hearing these as the Austin Public Library and the Library Foundation prepare to wrap up this year's Mayor's Book Club with an afternoon with author Susan Orlean. That's at the Central Library tomorrow, November 9th. Details at austinlibrary.org. This is a time of year when you might see giant spiders climbing around Central Texas because it's mating season for the Texas brown tarantula. And we get that story from the Texas Standard's Kristen Cabrera.
Oh my God, this one's huge.
Bonnie Martin and her family live on the outskirts of Northwest Austin. After 14 years in their home, they're not strangers to the occasional wandering wild thing. But this October morning was slightly different.
My daughter was leaving for school and walked outside, and she came running in about 30 seconds later and was screaming at me, "Oh my God, there's a huge spider!"
Bonnie threw on her shoes and ran outside. Above the garage, she noticed a large black spot, and it was moving.
And sure enough, it is this massive tarantula.
Sound familiar? There you are, minding your own business, and out of the corner of your eye, it's a spider, but not just any spider. Chances are, especially for this time of year in Texas, it's likely to be the king of spiders. And he's out looking for his queen. Dave Mullendorf is sort of an aficionado when it comes to Texas tarantulas.
Hello, how are you doing?
Oh, yep,
yeah.
I met him at Zookeeper, an exotic pet shop he manages in Austin. He says right now, we're in the thick of mating season for the Texas brown tarantula. And those fellas, they're all dressed up and ready to find love.
It's because they're out wandering looking for the females. What happens a couple of times a year is the males, they spend all their life in their burrows or under rocks or wherever they happen to abide. And after they molt their skin the final time, they come out looking more sleek and basically armed and ready to go.
As the males prepare for their night on the town, the females, well, they'd rather just stay home, pour themselves a nice glass of wine, and cozy up with a good book. Well, not exactly, but as Texas A&M entomologist Wizzy Brown says, during the mating season, the female Texas brown tarantula is really just a homebody.
The females, they create a nice little burrow, and they pretty much hunker down in there, and they hang out, and they may come out to get some food and stuff like that, but they stay in that general area.
So how does an eligible tarantula find a mate?
They buy her a drink and, you know, everything's good. So they have different chemical signals that they use. There's vibrations that they use. So there's all these different other communication methods since they don't talk like us.
male tarantulas in the wild only live a season or two, while the females, much like us human women, tend to outlive them.
But they can live surprisingly a long time, anywhere from like 8 to 25 years. And that usually really creeps people out. They're like, wait, a tarantula is living for 25 years? That's absolutely insane.
By now, Bonnie Martin is used to these furry critters. But still, she gets that lingering, creepy feeling.
Just about every time I turn to my side to get something, for a split instance, I think, oh my God, what if there's another one?
Which is something that Mark Power says is universal.
It is common that of the U.S. population, about 60% would report that they don't like spiders, but only about 10% would meet criteria for a phobia.
He's a clinical psychologist and the director of trauma research at Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas. Basically, his whole job is to study fear.
Well, actually, you're talking to a person who used to have a phobia of spiders.
Not only did Mark get over his phobia of spiders, he used that knowledge and experience to help others do the same. For some, it came with an unexpected side effect.
They may have gone from having a phobia of spiders to, after treatment, actually buying their own tarantula. And I actually started buying tarantulas myself. And if it weren't for my wife, I'd keep them at home as well.
At the exotic pet shop, arachnid specialist Dave Mollendorf knows tarantulas are a special kind of pet. But just because they're furry doesn't mean they're meant for cuddling.
You know, they don't really like to be held. They'll tolerate it, but they don't really prefer it. And actually, if you got one and you held it and you dropped it, it would pop like a bag of jelly. It would kill it.
And disturbing a wild male as he heads out to find his tarantula sweetheart, that can be a death sentence for him.
The males are much shorter lived. And of course, when the males come out looking for love, that's when you start finding them all over the roads. But if you find one, just leave it alone. Let it go.
If you're thinking, but what happens if it bites me? Well, as expert Wizzy Brown puts it, it'll just feel like a bee sting. Because Texas tarantulas, they're not deadly.
I always get the are they going to kill me question. No, they're not going to kill you.
Bottom line, these are nothing but misunderstood star-crossed lovers. It's not their fault we think they're creepy. So if your paths do cross, don't worry. Wizzy says they've got more important places to be.
They're not wanting to attack you. I mean, that is not their purpose. Especially the males, they're kind of on a mission, and so they really don't want to be interrupted.
And in the end, isn't looking for love scary enough? For the Texas Standard, I'm Kristen Cabrera.
That's KUT Weekend for the second weekend of November 2019. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶